Vous êtes avec SBS French.
Adam Elliott, who is the creator, the father, the inspiration for animation that he's going to speak about himself. Welcome.
Hello.
Adam, you have decided at some stage or other in your life that animation was your way of expressing yourself. When did it happen?
Well, look, I was a late bloomer. I didn't discover animation until I was about 25. I mean, of course, I'd always seen cartoons on television and seen animated feature films like that had come from Disney and the like, but I never had a burning, burning aspiration to become an animator. But it wasn't until I stumbled across the Victorian College of the Arts here in Melbourne that I realised that animation was a wonderful combination of all the things that I enjoyed already. I've always liked drawing. I've always loved making things. I love photography. I love telling stories. I love entertaining people. So it was a wonderful amalgamation of all the things I'd already enjoyed in my life.
Your animation at the beginning really would have been inspired, as you say, by the sources. But you have added a certain number of levels of reading to the animation and to the characters, and they're deceptively simple.
Yes, well, at film school I had a wonderful lecturer, Sarah Watt, who of course is a very now well-known live-action Australian director. And she taught me that, you know, really as artists, as if we wanted to call ourselves artists, an artist's job is to push the boundaries and present to the audience or the viewer something new and original. And at the time I found a lot of animation very prescribed and formulaic and predictable, and I really wanted to push the boundaries and have always wanted to push the boundaries. And because if an art form becomes stagnant, it dies. So really, I've always wanted to present the audience with something new and refreshing, and the consequence is that the films I've made have been perceived and viewed as in some people's eyes as groundbreaking. I wouldn't call them groundbreaking, but I do see them as very different to the mass of animation that is generated every year.
I think there's a question of difference of rhythm. There's a question of also the depth of the characters that you are presenting, even though there is a quirky, light-hearted humour about the characters and what they say. There's at least two or three readings about the dialogues, and therefore you can actually access it at the level you want or the level you know. And we tend to forget the cartoons.
Well, that's my aim, and I love the compliment that I get when people say that within a few minutes of watching one of my films, they forget that what they're watching is an animation and that these characters become very real people. You know, at the moment, of course, everybody's talking about 3D animation and 3D this and 3D that, and really, to me, the 3D is about the emotional depth of the characters, the dimension of the characters' lives. I'm not obsessed with all the technology. I'm more obsessed with the story and creating very authentic, real and believable characters. And yes, they are animated, but you can show a film with plasticine blobs on screen that does
look human.
And look human and evoke empathy and compassion. And yeah, I want the audience, so when they leave the cinema, that they are genuinely affected by what they've seen.
I felt very touched by the characters. I felt very touched by the previous character as well, and the little victim of the Industrial Revolution, who ended up having a very simple life, but he liked his life. Those characters don't ask very much out of life. They get their little pleasures. They're the little lives, and that's very important.
Well, of course, yeah, I think everybody's lives can be celebrated and everybody has a biography and everybody has a story to tell. And I'm not concerned with the heroes in life. Or, well, I suppose my characters are anti-heroes. But I believe that there's so many people out there who lead very ordinary yet extraordinary lives, and they're the people whose lives I want to celebrate and put on the big screen.
One of the French interviewers on radio for about 20 years was a man called Jacques Chancel, and he could do the most marvelous interviews with truck drivers as well as the celebrities of his time. And his motto was in fact twofold. One was, I give people what they like, but also give them what they could like. And his second motto was, everybody has an interesting story to tell.
Absolutely. I totally subscribe to his philosophy. I mean, depending on the way you tell the story, it is all about a good story well told in the end. But I believe that even the most mundane and seemingly ordinary people do have rich and interesting stories to tell. It's just finding those stories is the tricky part, and working out a way to present that story in an engaging and fascinating way. I mean, there are many wonderful stories out there, but a lot of those stories just get, it is in the delivery. A lot of those stories get told in a very bland way, and I think you have to concentrate on the delivery of the story just as much as the content of the story.
But in your case, I think people feel that they're looking at real people when, in fact, as you say, they're blobs of plasticine, but we forget about this. So there is that aspect of it. But the fact that your films are so successful, in a sense, they touch people's hearts from the prizes and from the way your films are greeted. But you also put into it, you've deconstructed enough the art of animation to be able to express the human element in an inanimate object.
Well, yes, I definitely set very difficult challenges for myself, but I much prefer to work with actors who are made of plasticine because I have a lot of creative control. I don't have to worry about actors having tantrums there are many benefits to telling a story via animation, and I always get asked, when am I going to move into live action films? And I'm quite baffled by that, because no one ever says to a live action director, when are they moving into animation or plasticine? So I think for me too, it's creating characters that are very universal and characters that are archetypes that everybody around the world can relate to in some way and empathize with, because really at the end of the day what I'm trying to do is get the audience to put themselves in my character's shoes, and even though they are, as you say, blobs of plasticine.
Do we forget that?
You forget that very quickly, yes.
It touches the heart, and therefore it also sends you back as a spectator or as a viewer a mirror of something in you, whether it's a vulnerability or some of the little pleasures like the characters that you're looking at, which you sometimes find also very pleasurable. I'm just wondering, in the case of this particular film, Mary and Max, you mentioned the universality, and you have two cities, or you have two continents, really. One is in Australia, the other one is in New York, and the thread between them is a correspondence. Now, where did you get that inspiration?
My friends always say I was born in the wrong decade.
I was about to say that. It feels very much like the 40s. Am I right or not?
Well, no. Well, it starts in the 70s, but we deliberately made the film feel like it's unclear when exactly the time period is, but it's sort of somewhere around the 60s and 70s onwards. And I'm not interested in making films that are about modern day. For some reason, I'm just attracted to things that are almost archaic and very traditional. But I wanted to make a film about my pen friend, and I've had a pen friend who I've been writing to for over 20 years, and of course pen friendships are almost archaic and obsolete because of email and all these other ways we can communicate now. But it's been amazing. I still get emails from people who tell me they still have pen friends, and my pen friend and I have had a very enriching relationship over the last 20 years. We've never met, but I find him a fascinating person, and so I decided to base this film on his life.
And also yours.
And mine, yes. Well, I thought, well, how am I going to put myself in the film? So I transformed myself into an 8-year-old girl called Mary Dinkle, and she lives in the suburb of Mount Waverley in Melbourne, and that's where I was raised. I really wanted to, it is a film about friendship, long-distance friendship, and even though the two characters never meet, they still affect each other's lives and learn from each other.
And support each other when things are going wrong or when things are a bit lonely.
Yes, and I think loneliness is one of the themes in the film, melancholy, and, you know, I think everybody has felt lonely at some period in their lives. Some people are more lonely than others, of course, but I think that's why the film has done so well all around the world, is that everybody can relate to these two very unusual and seemingly strange characters. But I think at the end of the day, we're all slightly strange. We are all slightly imperfect. We all have flaws, and we all crave companionship and to be respected and embraced.
And as I said, I think not only there's the empathy because it touches your heart, but also because I think it throws back a mirror to you watching.
Yes, a lot of people comment that after they've seen Mary and Max in particular, that the sensation of watching the film tends to linger for a few days. They can't work out why the film has affected them so much, and that is, again, deliberate. I really want to penetrate the audience. I want to not only nourish the audience, but I want to provoke as many emotions as I possibly can, because I believe going to the cinema should be a full body experience. You know, you should walk out of that cinema feeling exhausted, almost, that you've not only had a good laugh, but you've had a good cry and perhaps even been enlightened somehow.
Well, it's certainly achieving that point, but you're doing it with a very great deal of work and precision and research and using the skills of a whole army of people, of craftsmen, of photographers, of camera people. So it's not only the story, but you build the set around it. And I think this is the beauty of this exhibition at ACME, which we see in some way some of the phases of the construction of this odyssey, because it is a journey.
Yes, well, this has been the wonderful thing about this exhibition, is it's been given the opportunity to celebrate all the people who, of course, helped me make this film over a very long period, almost 5 years, and we had over 120 crew members. The budget was about $8 million, and every single prop, set and character you see on that big screen is a real tangible, tactile object that has been handcrafted. And so this exhibition is to celebrate those people who make me look good, I suppose, and those people who often get overlooked themselves. You know, we were talking about the film mirroring the viewer. Well, in a way, the film is about people who are marginalised and overlooked in life, and this is what this exhibition is celebrating, all those hundreds of people who sat in the dark for over a year, animating the characters, all those people who sculpted all the puppets, all those people who painted skylines, and we had costumes.
And sets and costumes. They're beautiful pieces.
Yes, and it's a bit like, I call them artefacts. What we're really showing to the public are the artefacts of the film. The audience will never fully appreciate the blood, sweat and tears that went into creating these thousands of little objects, and of course we can only show the audience a very small percentage of what we actually make, as a lot of it is destroyed in the process of filming. So yeah, it's been great that ACME have given me this opportunity.
But it's also one to arouse some vocations about people who are going to be visiting this particular exhibition. I'm thinking that it's really a decor in the European French way. It's a set. It's a proper set with all the details and the minutiae of period and time. And the costumes are extraordinary. Those shoes, those glasses.
Yes.
We tend to forget that they don't have features. They've really got just eyes and a nose and somehow something for the mouth. And yet, they're so real. because they're dressed and because they move into what looks like rooms. It's extraordinary.
It was a wonderful coincidence, but last week Jean-Pierre Jeunet, of course, a very French director, was in town, and he had seen Mary Max several times in Paris, and we'd never met, but we finally got to meet, and I showed him through the exhibition, and you know, we realised there were many commonalities between
Absolutely.
The two of us. And, of course, his films are very similar to mine in that they're very dense. They're full of these interesting objects. And he does also celebrate people who are marginalised and
That's
perceived
right.
as different. And so there is a real European flavour to the film. Of course, so much animation that comes out of that is created every year now is computer-generated and exists really on a hard drive. So that's the other thing too. We wanted to remind the public that Mary Max is a handcrafted film and made in a very traditional manner, and so many animated films these days are not. They're all generated in computers. Of course, they're just as complex to make and just as expensive, and of course you still need a good story. But our film is definitely unusual, I suppose.
It is unusual, and you're quite right about the coincidence of this, because I interviewed Jean-Pierre Jeunet last week, and I have seen practically all his films save one, and the same atmosphere, but of course real sets for people with normal size are necessary, but it's for logistics of creating certain things, because his cars never look like cars, and then of course he doesn't go for special effects. He goes for a certain pretense at special effects. I don't know whether you had a chance to see Meet Mac, but when you can, you should.
Oh yes, it's wonderful. Yeah, I saw it at the opening night of the French film.
Oh good, you were there.
And, it was a real thrill because, as you say, Jean-Pierre also, he avoids sort of computer special effects.
Absolutely.
And prefers what we call in camera, which means everything you see on the big screen was shot live.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, again, we realised despite our geographical differences and cultural differences, we were both surprised at each other's similarities, and our ethoses and our sensibilities were very aligned. It was a real honour to meet Jean-Pierre, and I'm looking forward to meeting him again in Paris this year.
I think that you'll have a lot to talk about, but again, you choose the same subjects as well. The people broken by life are given another chance for joy and happiness. And in the case of Micmac, a good dose of well-deserved revenge.
Oh, that revenge scene at the end of the film.
It's wonderful.
It's wonderful.
We dream of it.
But it is, yeah. Wouldn't that be good if that was true?
Adam Elliott, I think your films are very moving. And to see in the same week the exhibition and Micmac was in fact like being on the same wavelengths and travelling in the same direction.
Well, yes, we're all very lucky to have Jean-Pierre visit us here in Melbourne. Of course, he's one of France's most famous directors, and for him to come to little old Melbourne has been a real honour, and the Victorian public feel very proud that we've had a visit from him.
And, you know, it goes back a long way, because next week there is a very special ceremony where the descendant of the Lumière assistant, the Lumière brothers assistant who came to Australia to set up the Australian film industry, his descendants, which are his great-great-grandchildren, are there to actually hand over a film that was made in Australia and never seen, a one-minute film. So we're talking cinema at the moment. We're all conjugating the word cinema in many contexts.
So that's a coincidence too, because last year I visited
Lyon, the Lumière Centre.
So there must be something Melbourne and
well, there was. It was really the earliest film made in Australia. And this one was The Ungraceful Skater. So in fact, it's a one-minute film. It's a bit like L'Arroseur Arrosé, which was the first one made by the Lumière brothers, of the man holding the hose and then getting splashed by water.
Yes.
But the one that was known as part of the collection was the 1894 Melbourne Cup.
Ah, yes.
He helped set up and help with this. But this film, I believe, was filmed in Melbourne. Then he took it back, but no one saw it again until recently, where great-grandchildren started opening boxes.
Wow.
Well, and it's being handed over to the National Archives.
Ah, fantastic. Well, there's a lot of connections in Melbourne and Leon, yes. And also, apparently, you know, there's still arguments as with the Ned Kelly very first feature film, and of course, it was made in Victoria somewhere.
It was made in Victoria in 1904, but I think by that time it had probably gone back. But
yes,
it would have been his influence, and he certainly would have set up and trained people. But the 1894 Melbourne Cup, it certainly was under his skill. There was also Soldiers of the Cross in 1902, which was part slides and part filming. But I don't think he was involved with that. I think there was just another film apart from that one. And then, of course, that comical little sketch.
Well, I look forward to...
So you'll have to go to Canberra
see it. And I'll have to tell Jean-Pierre as well when I'm next in Paris.
Do that, because at the time I heard about it after I had interviewed Jean-Pierre. Otherwise, I would have passed on the information because they're giving it to the archives.
Oh, fantastic.
So it will be there for Australians. Thank you very much, Adam. Our paths will cross, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, my pleasure, and thank you for the interview. And, of course, I hope everyone gets along to see the exhibition. It's on till June, and the best part about it is it's free.
Vous voulez entendre d'autres rubriques comme celle-ci? Écoutez-les sur Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify ou n'importe où vous obtenez vos podcasts.